I'm Nicholas Kenyon, and I'm the Managing Director of the Barbican Centre in London. I think if anybody deserves the title of a pioneer, Chris Hogwood does, because there he was at the very beginning of the early music consort in those remarkable days with David Munro. And he was able to build on that and gravitate beyond it into the formation of the Academy of Ancient Music. And I think now one looks back at that period, the early 70s were an absolutely decisive time. And there was a new family of players willing to risk things, recapture these forgotten instruments and techniques. And Chris was the great advocate for it. And he was then able to bring it to a very wide public.
I'm David Thomas, and I was a bass singer. My career in all lasted about 42 years, and a great deal of that was with Chris. I was one of those superior, rather horrid choral scholars from King's, and Chris was a very talented and low-key person who played the harpsichord and directed a bit, and he, for some reason, asked me to do a performance of Aces and Galatea, and I think David Munro was playing the recorder. We admired hugely Thurston Dart, who was the a professor at the time, and we heard him playing Continuo in the St. Matthew Passion in the chapel, and it always appeared to be so incredibly imaginative and exotic. And so when I came across Chris's playing, which was much more subtle and restrained and accurate, as a young man, the impression was, oh, well, maybe he's not very good because Thurston does this and does that, you know. But, of course, looking back now, we realise that Chris, as ever, was right on the ball and approaching it from the right direction.
James Bowman, countertenor.
I first met Chris late 67 stroke 68, when I was working with David Munro. And David said, oh, we're having Christopher Hogwood, he's joining the group. And I thought, oh, good, you know, I knew who he was. I knew him by reputation. And the first time we really performed together was at a series of concerts around the Midlands. And he was quite shy. And he was very beautiful, with lots of long hair. The Early Music Consort was one of the few groups playing on period instruments, instruments of the epoch, as they call it. We were so unauthentic, it just wasn't true. It was laughable. But, you know, needs must in those days.
Nicholas Kenyon.
Everybody who was involved in the early music movement, I think, originally went into it for the purpose of discovering repertory that had been forgotten or not very well performed. And that was, of course, the whole David Munro axis, of which Chris was a great part. I always remember Chris saying that his reservation about the early music consort was that slightly too much of it was imagined, and that it was one invention piled on top of another at the time. But it worked with the public. And then Chris adopted a far more evidence-based approach, if you like, to his work with AAM. And what happened then, I think, was that the record companies became suddenly attracted by the idea of not unfamiliar repertory, which they had to sell to a public who didn't know the names of Bieber or Schmelzer or Muffet, but they could sell Mozart and Beethoven, and everybody knew those names. So there was an enormous thirst for the product.
My name's Catherine Bott, and I am a singer. And one of the proudest moments in my whole career was being chosen to sing the role of Purcell's Dido under the baton of Christopher Hogwood. Recording with him and performing with him has been a great joy as a singer. I was aware of him when I was a teenager as a member of the Early Music Consort of London and, of course, as a wonderful broadcaster of eclectic stuff in one of the BBC's sporadic attempts to attract a teenage audience. Well, I think actually The Young Idea was one of the last programmes that really worked because I listened to it and so did my music-loving friends. It was compulsory listening.
He had such a deft way of illuminating what he talked about and what he played, really informative without being patronising. I think it set a whole new style for informed broadcasting that wasn't pompous and condescending. And certainly when I went to Radio 3, that was the sort of style that one tried to emulate and to develop. And I think that idea of the enthusiast who is knowledgeable, the performer who is well-informed in a scholarly sense, those two things are things that Chris embodies perfectly. I do think it's important also to record how much what he did with AAM grew out of his experience with groups, for instance, like the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, working with Neville Marriner as a continuo player. And I think he also absorbed an enormous amount of Neville's incredible professionalism about how to make recordings and how to make all that work.
This is Neville Marriner speaking, and I'm a conductor. I would imagine that the first time we met would be actually on the job, in fact, in the studio, and when Christopher was really taking over all the responsibilities that Thurston Dart had left us with. For me, he was always the fresher side of musicology. With Bob Dart, we always felt that he was the father of sort of our musicological ambitions. But when Christopher came along, he was different. He certainly, in many ways, he was more specific, I think, than Bob Dart was. Bob would always say that, you know, an ornament is played the way you feel. It's put there for you to express yourself. Whereas Christopher, I think, was much more intent on accuracy as far as this was concerned. Christopher stayed with us as our, advisor until he couldn't stand it anymore because we never really fulfilled his ambition, I don't think, certainly about style. And, of course, we didn't play on early instruments.
James Bowman.
I was always very impressed by the work that Chris did with Marriner. I've got several recordings that Chris had a big hand in, most notably the Handel organ concertos, which I love. I think he did a lot to make the Academy play in a more authentic way. He made them do their trills from the upper note, for a start. He put in much more tasteful ornamentation. As Neville himself used to say, we've been Hogwoodized.
He did many editions for us, and I don't think we ever really followed them to the letter. And I'm sure the appearance of the Academy of Ancient Music was entirely due to his frustration with the other academy.
Chris was quite rightly straining at the leash to move off in another direction with his own orchestra, which, of course, we all know he did, with enormous success.
He wrote a very polite letter saying that he hoped we wouldn't mind that he was starting his own orchestra. For him, it was the great joy was to have an orchestra where he could actually reproduce the sound that he really wanted.
Catherine McIntosh, and I was the leader of the Academy of Ancient Music from 1973 until 1988. I think Chris was always prepared to stick his neck out, and starting the Academy of Ancient Music was a huge step for the early music movement. There are many, many orchestras now, which I think probably wouldn't exist if it weren't for Chris's pioneering years. So we do owe him a huge debt of gratitude. I was aware, I don't know whether many were, that Chris was funding the orchestra out of some of his other work, and so it was like a child to him.
My name's James Jolly. I'm editor-in-chief of Gramophone magazine. I was editor for many years, about 15 years, and I also co-host Classical Collection on Radio 3 weekday mornings. I've been an avid record collector and a huge consumer of record reviews, particularly Gramophone, since I was about 15, so from the mid-70s on. So I think I knew almost entirely what he'd done on record. He struck me as an incredibly vital force in music making, somebody who made us listen anew to music we thought we knew incredibly well. Chris gathered round him an early music company, not just instrumentalists, but singers. And I think in a way that defined for many people the sound of early music. I mean, if one singer personifies early music in a lot of people's minds, it has to be Emma Kirkby.
I am Emma Kirkby. Chris, I think, was notoriously loyal to his singers. It was wonderful. If you were the sort of singer that could fulfil what he wanted, then he really did bend over backwards to keep using you, which is very, very nice. David Thomas was one of his stalwarts for very good reasons. That is such a characterful voice.
Chris particularly brought it home to me that my voice did suit the idiom. The bass voice at that time used an extreme range, and it happened to be a gift that I had. I could sing high and very low, and so my voice fitted that range.
Chris is singer-friendly. He doesn't dismiss singers as empty, vapid non-entities, unless they're hopeless, of course. He was very loyal to me and tended not to use a great deal of other countertenors, which I thought was very sweet of him. I did an enormously iconic recording with Chris of the Vivaldi Stabat Mater. I I remember the excitement and of recording it with him, because it was a totally new approach to do some virtuoso Baroque music away from the repertoire we had been doing. And I remember Decca saying to Chris, "Oh, nobody's going to buy that. It's so endless copies." And they paid me £100 to make it, and that was the end of it. But I didn't mind. It was a wonderful visiting card.
Pergolesi Stabat Mater with James, I think it sort of sneaked up on us, really. It was a great joy to do. It caught on very widely, and though there have been many very fine recordings since, it does seem to have a life of its own, that one.
I'm Paul Hughes, General Manager of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and in 1989, I joined the Academy of Ancient Music as general manager. Peter Wadland was the chief producer of Florilegium, L'Oiseau Lear, and so pretty well produced all of the recordings that the Academy of Ancient Music did. And it was at a time when record companies were, you know, making huge quantities of records, and Peter, I think, had the same pioneering spirit that Chris did, allied to this extraordinarily outrageous camp cheekiness that made him great company. He was a very funny man, and we miss him to this day. Peter had very good taste, very good ears. They both knew what they wanted and knew what they were after.
James Jolly.
Chris and Peter did enjoy this extraordinary creative relationship. Peter was an enormously enthusiastic producer, and he was incredibly passionate about everything, you know, from the sleeve design to who wrote the booklet notes to who the performers would be. It was a fantastic meeting of two very, very creative individuals.
I am John Dunkley. I was with Decca for 30 years. And the first recording that Christopher and Peter made together, if I remember correctly, was a record of Thomas Arne overtures. It required a very small string section, was fairly cheap to put together. There weren't very many original instrument players at that time. It seemed to be a very good way of putting one's toe in the original instrument waters, which were then basically very small beer. The initial challenges of playing on gut strings was very much a learning curve. We did not realise that there would be so many problems with humidity, with temperature, giving consequent problems with intonation. And as little or no vibrato was used, any intonation problems, however slight, would become exaggerated. Therefore, many retakes were required in the very early days. It was almost like an audition record. It was very much a testing the waters by Peter and Christopher to see whether it would be a success.
Had it not been for the sheer tenacity of both Christopher and Peter in persuading a much larger group of artists and repertoire producers that this could grow into something important, serious, and commercially viable, I doubt if Christopher would be as well known as he is now.
I believe the next major project was the complete Purcell Theatre music, which again was a very attractive project
in that it required very small forces and also allowed Christopher to start to work with some very good young singers, people like Emma Kirkby.
I was first aware of Christopher Hogwood, I think, as a member of the Early Music Consort, and then as the founder and conductor of the Academy of Ancient Music. And it so happened that we ended up working for the same record label. I was working with the Consort of Music and Anthony Rulli, and I think it was through them that Chris decided, yes, there would be perhaps some role for me in his Purcell project. And I just couldn't believe my luck, to be honest. It was it was a wonderful place to begin.
Catherine Bott.
Thinking about Christopher Hogwood and Henry Purcell, they're both quintessentially English, but Purcell knew French and Italian music. He brought that into his own music making. And Chris brings a great deal of culture. That's a dirty word these days, but he's a cultured man. And that, I think, is very rare, because people often don't expect musicians, at whatever level, whether they're conductors or singers or orchestral players, to be generally cultured in the other arts. Music for a while.
Shall all your cares be gone? Catherine McIntosh.
When the Purcell recording started, then he asked me to lead. Chris and I had a very natural rapport in our outlook towards music. We neither of us were particularly interested in going for super flamboyant effects. And when we were working on recordings, preparing the recordings, he would leave the bowings up to me, and Chris was always very supportive in the way that I felt, and vice versa.
There are quite a lot of people coming up now in early music who are, like me, secondary sources people. The people who look things up on the internet and read people's books. But Chris has always gone for the primary source. He really knows whereof he speaks. He has a very quiet and good-humoured authority, which is a great pleasure to work with, and I think it's becoming perhaps a bit of a rarity.
Paul Hughes.
I can't think of anybody who combines the erudition and scholarship with the joy of music making to quite the same extent that Chris does. And he carries all of that lightly.
The bringing together of scholarship and performance is something that absolutely lies at the heart of what you could call the early music revival, because it has needed people who were scholars in their own right, but there are very few people who have it in the right balance, and that is exactly what Chris does have, that balance between being a performer who can bring music to life at the moment when it happens, making those decisions, and the scholar who can, in a thoughtful and reflective way, decide what is the best way to perform something and everything that lies behind that. And those two opposite poles don't always come together in such a perfect balance as they do in Chris's work.
Thank you. David Thomas.
Chris's approach to music is obviously scholastic, but that doesn't really come through in his performance. He does all the research beforehand. He finds out about where it was performed and when and how many times and what the forces involved were and what sort of music they used. Did they have stands? He'll know all those sort of questions. But then when he gets onto the platform, that doesn't get in the way at all. He allows you to interpret. He encourages. You don't get that dreadful tyrant effect that we get with so many of our conductors, I'm afraid, who beat you up until they get exactly what they want.
James Bowman.
I learned more about baroque performing practice from Chris than anybody else. He would tactfully suggest things at given points while one was performing, and one would just imbibe them and assume them without being bullied into doing them.
Emma Kirkby.
There's no doubt that Chris's intellect is a very, very active creature. He's always looking for new angles on things, and he is a very educational person to be around. He really enjoys getting things right, but in a way that is joyful rather than sterile and dull.
My name is Christopher Purvis, and I am the current chairman of the Academy of Ancient Music. Chris and I got to know each other first back in 1996, I think it was, when we were both on the board of the charity which had been set up by Stanley Sadie to create a museum in the house in which Handel lived, worked and died, Handel House. What I found so refreshing about Christopher's approach to Handel House was that he understood that one mustn't be completely hidebound by the academic approach. He understood that there needed to be music in the house, and we found that we clicked immediately, and I would like to think that we've been friends from that day to this.
I always enjoyed, especially, doing a big Handel project with Chris, because I liked his input, the fact that he never sold out to vulgarity. He always kept within certain parameters of good taste, which he's never abandoned. He lets the music speak for itself, but when the AAM are really going great guns, it's an incredibly exciting sound. Chris's Handel was a revelation. It was his tempi, it was the clarity of his instrumentation. He didn't, you know, there was no muddiness. It was always crystalline. It was like something that could come straight out of the dishwasher.
John Dunkerley.
He was incredibly fortunate to be starting to make records in what now is considered almost the golden era of recording. Certainly as he started in the late 60s, went through the 70s and 80s, with, I must add, an incredibly supportive producer in Peter Wadland, who believed in what they were all doing and had the ability and the backing of a major company to allow them to do so many wonderful projects together. As CDs started to sell in very large quantities, it became very clear to the record industry at large that one could sell almost any title, which was a great temptation to a lot of the major companies to duplicate repertoire. With Christopher and Wazilier, they were not into duplicating repertoire. They were into discovering how far they could go with performing practice, and discovering new repertoire meant going into the classical and almost into the romantic periods, which was a journey of discovery for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
people suddenly discovered that they could have a new collection, new versions on a digital medium. Some people started to collect exactly what they had on vinyl. Others thought, let us look at some of the new performing versions. And that gave a great boost to the authentic movement. It was no longer the stuff of train spotting and anoraks. It became quite a mainstream interest.
Nicholas Kenyon.
The big decisive moment in terms of making AAM and that whole Oiseau Lyre thing very popular was The Messiah that Chris recorded, and which I think came to the proms around 1980 or so, where everybody said, yes, this is it.
If I were to look back and be given my sort of Desert Island Discs recordings with Christopher, I would certainly put Messiah amongst the top of those.
Catherine McIntosh.
The recording which I hold most dear is Messiah, which we recorded in the late 70s. Chris and I worked quite a lot on the preparation for that together. And I think we both had the feeling that we'd always wanted it to sound different from how we'd heard it before. I still think it has a freshness which I don't remember hearing in any other recording.
I was extraordinarily lucky to do The Messiah with Chris in the very late 70s because he chose to do a slightly unusual version which needed two sopranos. And therefore I was fed in at what was a pretty early stage for me to sing pieces sopranos don't normally sing. So that was a huge piece of luck because I didn't need to be compared all the time to other people's versions. And that's quite liberating. And I didn't have to worry about the big pieces because somebody else was doing those. That was perfect.
One of my most amazing memories of working with Chris was the Hollywood Bowl, where we did Messiah in front of 17,000 people. Chris was slightly worried because when the audience gets bored, they roll beer bottles down from the top and they go clunk, clunk, clunk. But there were no beer bottles for Messiah. It was wonderful. And the beautiful blue Californian sky as the sun fades away is just a magical memory, I have to say. The trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised.
With the considerable success of Handel's Messiah, it suddenly became clear to Chris and to Peter that the record contract could be made a much larger device. I seem to remember at that point it suddenly started to be 10, possibly more records a year, which, if one considers the industry now, is almost unimaginably generous.
Paul Hughes.
Orlando is such a wonderful piece of music, and it was James Bowman in his prime. It was a big piece. We got to perform it at the proms. It was one that we had to persuade Decca to do, but I think it still stands the test of time as a recording.
point about Orlando is it really has to be a man, because all the other characters are women. I've seen Orlando done with a female, and it becomes like a lesbian fest. You've really got to have a slightly mad male figure in the middle. It's one of the few Handel operas that I think really has to be sung by a man, because the countertenor voice has got is perhaps a little distray or deranged, and the fact that he goes off the rails in the middle. I mean, if a woman does it, it sounds too easy and too comfortable.
My vengeance awaits me, compassion forsakes me. Compassion forsakes me. Oh, softness and mercy, away! Away! Compassion forsakes me, oh, softness, away! Away, away!
James Jolly.
And one shouldn't overlook the extraordinary recording of Athaliah, which brought together Joan Sutherland and Emma Kirkby and Alla Jones, you know, three singers you'd probably never expect to find on the same disc. And I remember that won a gramophone award, and rightly so, because it was a very courageous piece of casting, and actually it was a terrific recording.
Catherine McIntosh.
One of the last recordings I made with Chris was Athaliah, and the great Dame Joan Sutherland was there, who famously was introduced by Peter Wadland, our producer, as somebody who he'd wanted to work with for years and years and years. And she said, "Yes, you know, I'm an ancient instrument too."
Sort of think of that recording as our equivalent of that film of Death on the Nile, you know, which it had such a span of soloists there. And Dame Joan was amazing. And I think Chris enjoyed that. They set up a good relationship. She was just so down to earth, so delightful. So that was a really wacky thing to do, but it worked very well.
Christopher Purvis.
The recording that I like best, because I was personally associated with it, I attended the rehearsals, I attended the performances in the Barbican and in Birmingham, was the Rinaldo with Daniels and Bartoli. And it was a real experience to see how he worked with these great singers. And he created one of the best Handel recordings there is.
Hush.
Period instrument orchestras at that time had focused a lot on the Baroque repertoire, so Bach, Vivaldi, Handel were absolutely core repertoire for the Academy of Ancient Music. And Chris was, as he is now, curious about so many other different types of music and pushing it later. So looking at Beethoven and Mozart at Haydn, and now one sees period instrument performance of Wagner even. But I think it was exciting at that time because it was at the height of the demand. CDs were flying off the shelves, they were getting awards, we were in demand for touring internationally. Chris had created a very, very recognisable brand, the Academy of Ancient Music, and I don't think it was that difficult to come in and capitalise on that.
He was very lucky because, you know, he recorded all the Mozart symphonies. He recorded the Beethoven symphonies, a vast amount of Baroque and pre-classical repertoire. The golden period of his musical career coincided very well with the golden age of the recording industry. The Haydn Symphony project was in sight of the goalpost when the final whistle was blown and the game was up, really, which was a shame because I think looking back, it would have been fantastic to have a complete cycle imbued with a sort of scholarship that was there in their approach to the Haydn Symphonies, you know, without the continuo and all the other various decisions they'd made. But hey-ho, that's how these things go. What sets him apart is that he was a musician who was probably as happy in the recording studio as he was in the concert hall. And he could create levels of energy and enthusiasm and passion in what might, to some people, be a rather sort of sterile environment. I mean, I think what characterises his music making is great levels of enthusiasm, great levels of energy. I mean, really palpable energy, a great attention to the sort of rhythmic life of a piece of music. And I think the sort of the scholar's approach that allows him to see the music in its very formal structure, but actually elevate that well beyond the sort of dry realms of academia into something much more connecting and communicative to an audience, be they in a concert hall or sitting at home listening to their stereo.
Catherine Bott.
It is lovely that he does choose the road less travelled. I'm particularly pleased, as a Haydn rather than a Mozart person myself, his championing of the music of Haydn, I think, is great and glorious, and you know, long may it last.
One of my favourites is the Haydn Creation recording. I think it's wonderful to have it sung in English, and with a lineup of singers that he gathered round, I mean, you can hear every word.
I love Creation because it has such a feeling of newness anyway. It is a white hot piece.
Christopher Purvis.
After we got to know each other through Handel House, Chris and I began to talk about the future of the Academy of Ancient Music. At that time, the AAM was completely synonymous with the name of Christopher Hogwood. And he had an extraordinary vision, indeed, I think I would say quite a considerable amount of courage, to be able to look at the possibility of an AAM without Hogwood.
Catherine McIntosh.
I think when one gets to a certain stage and age, one begins to realise that you are of a generation which is parental, in a sense. There are younger people coming along who have the energy and drive that you had at their age. And if you don't step back or sideways, you are effectively blocking the way for new talent. And I admire Chris for having done this with the Academy of Ancient Music.
Nicholas Kenyon.
I think it's been very generous of Chris to allow others to develop the ensemble as they have, to keep his links for the occasional project, and to now see it flourishing with Richard Egar must be a huge, huge pleasure, because here it is acquiring quite a different musical character in some respects from the ensemble that Chris founded, and yet keeping the flame alive. So in a sense, that's the ideal outcome, that a great ensemble can reinvent itself. A lot of the cross-currents, a lot of the cross-fertilisation that Chris very prominently has achieved in terms of getting modern orchestras to play in a more informed way, that has led to a whole sea change. And I think my own conclusion, though other people may not agree, is I think in very important ways the early music revolution has been won, because that attitude to performance now informs a huge range of ensembles, from the Vienna Philharmonic to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. In the course of one generation, my professional lifetime, and a lot of that is down to what Chris and his colleagues started in 1973.
Paul Hughes.
Chris later went on to conduct much more contemporary music and became a Martinu specialist, as we know. And I think that sort of curiosity beyond just the period instrument music meant that what the Academy of Ancient Music was doing was rooted very much in the music scene generally. And there was a tendency in the early days of period instrument music to think, this is how it needs to be. This is how it would have sounded. That's it. I don't think Chris was anywhere near as dogmatic as that. He said, this is how it might have sounded, this was how it could have sounded, and whether that's historically informed is based on the research, but that was just the starting point.
Whereas other conductors sort of started exploring music of the Baroque, pre-classical and classical period, and then took the lessons they'd learnt from working with period instruments into performing further and further into the 19th century, Chris leapt over the big romantic stuff and then reappeared when composers of the 30s were themselves exploring the music of the 18th century. So people like sort of Martinu and Stravinsky, who were writing neoclassical music. So in a way, they were going back and they were mining the sort of repertoire that Chris knew at first hand, things like sort of the Pergolesi repertoire that Stravinsky was mining. I think the series that Chris did for Arte Nova with the Bâle Chamber Orchestra is incredibly effective and extraordinarily wide-ranging. I mean, a lot of the repertoire that people like Paul Zacher commissioned, and he's done incredibly well, bringing the same kind of musical qualities, the precision, the rhythmic drive, the sort of the harmonic interest to modern instruments and playing this neoclassical repertoire. You know, he's a very major interpreter of Martinu's music. He has that rhythmic vitality about his music that's very appealing, harmonically fascinating. He never became overblown, even his symphonic works, which of course came quite late in his life. There's a sort of scale and a proportion, I think, that's very appealing. I can understand why Chris is drawn to his music, but actually he's done a phenomenal amount for Martinu, you know, rather like Mackerras has done for Jan Arček by preparing the edition. So not only has he taken his enthusiasm to the Czech Republic, but he's actually given them back rather more accurate scores than they were probably playing from originally.
Chris has been one of the people that's stretched me over the years, encouraged me into new repertoires. The most striking was Stravinsky, which I never thought I'd end up doing. But that was a very exciting thing to try. And I was aware, I've always been aware, that Chris's canvas is much wider than just early music.
No word from Tom. Has love no voice? Can love not keep her maiden vow in cities? Fate has the rose full rich display.
I'll tell you one that I find myself putting on repeatedly at moments of gloom, and that is the Boyce Symphonies. And that seemed to me to be absolutely in the heartland of the music that Chris loves, that 18th century English repertory, done with total buoyancy, total charm, total skill, and just a perfect match of interpretation and performance. And it never, ever fails to cheer me up.
I was flabbergasted to get a phone call and asking me to come and talk about him to celebrate his 70th birthday. There is no way that he is 70. He's obviously has a very, very splendid picture in his attic, and I'm wondering who's painted it.
Chris and I have been friends for many years now, and he is a lovely man. I owe an enormous amount to Christopher Hogwood. He saw that I had some talent, and I have to say, not everybody could see that, and he encouraged me enormously. But then he continued beyond encouragement and actually employed me for years, and I count myself as extremely fortunate to have known him. And Chris is always kind and fun, and never, in my memory anyway, rude and horrid.
Christopher Purvis.
I find that perhaps my very best friends are those who have very high, very demanding standards. And Chris has very, very demanding standards. But this is sometimes leads to him being quite tough on people. But I think that we need to be kept on our toes. And it, of course, it is not just enough to be tough. You also have to have that warmth, that feeling of being simpatico towards people. He is one of the most civilized human beings I know, a dear friend, and I wish him happy birthday.
Catherine Bott.
It's wonderful to sit at his feet and hear him talk about the music he loves. And that's not in any way to belittle all the other things he does. I just want to congratulate him and thank him for being one of the absolute best.
When Chris is performing, what you get always when it comes to the actual performance is a sense of occasion, a sense of joy, a sense of exuberance, and a sense of bringing the best out of people. And I think that's why he really is a very popular conductor all over the world with all sorts of different groups, because he's always working with positive energy. He's always has a sense of newness. It may be that he's trying to be exact and correct according to historical principles, but that in no way reduces the power of the moment of performance, which is where he really flourishes, I think, very happily, genially, but with power as well.
This 70th birthday tribute to Christopher Hogwood was made by Anthony Fabian. The musical excerpts came from Christopher Hogwood's discography for Decca, EMI Classics, Arte Nova and Supraphon. This is an Elysian audio production.